cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
You all know our next guest from the podcast On with Kara Swisher and Pivot. You see her on CNN, where she's a contributor. She's also a former contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. She co-founded the tech news site Recode. And then earlier in her career, she was also a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, where she founded the tech news site All Things D. And she was a reporter at the Washington Post.
All right, everybody. Her new book is Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. It details her more than 30 years covering the tech industry. We are delighted to have with us journalist and author Kara Swisher joining us now from Chicago. Hello, hello. That we love the book is an understatement. I think Tim and I both listened to it as audiobook, so it was fun to hear you narrate it. We want to get into the book, but you're welcome. We'd be remiss not to kind of ask you about kind of the broader, tech outlook, if you will, and some of the stories, whether it's the Reddit IPO, whether it's TikTok banning in the U.S., whether it's Apple and Google getting together on AI. What is it that you kind of find really, really interesting right now and that you think investors and like a Bloomberg audience or the audience at large should really be paying attention to?
Sure. Interestingly, I'd have to tell you something about that book. The audio version is selling the double the amount of the print version.
Wow.
It's on the bestseller list. So it's really interesting. So that to me, since my last book, which was 25 years ago, is a really interesting trend. Obviously, I do podcasts, so people like listening to me. So
did you narrate your other books, though, Kara?
I did, but nobody was listening.
So I wonder if it is the podcast.
There was no iPhone.
You know what's funny? So I listened to it on Spotify, which you can now listen to. So you can listen to it for free on Spotify if you're a subscriber. Carol bought it on a different service.
Audible.
Does it matter to you how someone listens to it?
I get paid no matter what.
That's all we care about. Okay.
Yeah, that's all I care about. I make content, which is why I'm kind of a media entrepreneur, but. The bigger picture, I mean, all of the above that you were talking about, whether it's AI, I interviewed Steve Huffman this morning for a rather long interview, which we're not going to publish till after the company goes public for obvious reasons. I've been following Reddit for 19 years. I just realized I've known him for 19 years when he was a kid, actually. Sam Altman, who I recently had on stage in San Francisco, also someone I met when he was 19 years old. Hmm. But, everything old is new again in a weird way. But I'm paying a lot of attention to climate change tech, to AI, obviously, and where it's going. There's a lot of machinations around that and lots of different permutations. I'm spending a lot of time thinking about healthcare tech and the impact of AI on that. And obviously the big companies and what's going to happen to them in media. Everybody, the end of media, as we know, it kind of the story that's been going on for 3 decades now.
Okay, so let's get to some of those things. I do want to start with Reddit and, your conversation with Steve today, notwithstanding. Does Reddit have what it takes to compete with the Meta platforms, the Alphabets, the Amazons, when it comes to advertising?
No.
I mean, this is how it makes its money.
Yeah. No, yeah, it does. It does okay. I mean, I think they're adjusted EBITDA. I get so confused when they try these things. They're not profitable in a traditional sense, but they, I think they have cash flow, which I think is what you need. They remind me more of Snapchat, but a different service, a very different kind of service. I mean, their business is small. 500 million users, 76 million daily users. I think that's the one they want to push people towards. I think it was $800 million in advertising. It's a drop in the bucket to what the other companies are doing. So it's a small social media site. Its strength is the decentralization of the content moderation and the decentralization of the service. It makes it a stronger and more enjoyable service. A lot more young people are on it. I have lots of kids, but my older kids who are 18, 19 and 21 use Reddit all the time and YouTube. That's pretty much it. Mm. They don't use any of those other sites. That's how they consume video, because they like the decentralized part of it, and they don't like where everyone's dumped in the same stew and have to yell at each other and point fingers. They're not interested. So I think it's an interesting business. I don't know if it's a huge business. They're starting to try to license data. That was a slightly controversial, selling Google the data feeds. But that's, everyone's going to do that, so I'm not sure why we pick on them particularly.
You know, it's interesting what you say, too, about your kids and a younger generation. I mean, mm-hmm. As Twitter tries to find out what it wants to be when it...
Don't call it Twitter, Carol.
What X wants to be.
You can call it whatever you want.
That is true. Please. I mean, does that give Reddit an opening in your view? Like, I'm trying to figure out what's the role of Reddit.
It's not the same service. Yeah. Twitter has now become a toxic waste dump, really, pretty much. And a place where a billionaire works out all his childhood traumas in front of us in real time. And is ugly character at this point. But no, I think it's different. It's a little more like TikTok if you think about it. It's interests. Mm. Like you're interested in skiing or you're interested in video games. It's decentralized, and so that's a power. That's a very powerful thing to do, to be in this time where again there's these central feeds of which you can't really pick and choose. So in that way, TikTok, it's more akin to TikTok in that regard. And also the advertising is context. It's that contextual advertising, not the kind that's creepy and gross. So they're going to make less money because they're not as creepy and gross as other services. So I like the service. I think it's quite good. I just don't think it's a huge business. They might try commerce. They've been talking in their filings about commerce, but that's a nascent business.
But
it makes sense to try.
You mentioned TikTok. We've all been, you know, talking about TikTok, as you would guess. Everybody has over the last week or so. Should it be banned in the U.S.? What's the future?
I have talked about this for years, so it's. I'm like, yeah, you're talking about this now. I wrote a column in the New York Times a couple of years ago saying I thought it was one of the best new products I had seen in a while, and this was before it got really popular. But that I used it on a burner phone because of the Chinese Communist Party and the potential for spying, and not just spying, because more propaganda and abuse by a foreign adversary. And so I was trying to call attention to the fact that now, look, I think I really do believe the TikTok executives when they say they're not up in our grill at the same, although there's been instances of them being up in the grill of certain things. But I don't care at this point because they could be. They could be. And every Chinese tech company I've covered has the Chinese Communist Party up in their grill. It just has happened. And honestly, why wouldn't they be? I mean, that makes sense for, you know, even to use the platform to their purposes. If we had reciprocity in China, I might have a different point of view. Mm-hmm. And by the way, they're not going to let us because guess what we do? We propagandize and we'd surveil. I mean, obviously. So I'm not sure. I think it's a national security issue. I've seen enough proof of it. I don't think you should necessarily trust the government saying it is, but there's no question that we would not allow China to buy CNN. Much smaller, considerably smaller. It's a broadcast network, and it should be regulated like a broadcast network.
Yeah, and even Rupert Murdoch
tech is media.
Yeah, even before Rupert Murdoch
had
before
become,
he bought, he
you know, and then he did his endless damage on the American democracy. Well, but he had to be an American to do it.
Okay, we'll get to media, more media in just a bit. I do want to stick with TikTok and go bigger picture here. You make an interesting point in your book at the end of the book, the whole book about technology and your role covering technology over the last 30 years. About looking away from our phones, looking up from our phones, and spending less time on them. And it makes me think about the several issues that I talk to people that they have about TikTok. One is that, you know, of course, all the stuff that you brought up with national security concerns. But two, it's that, you know, they can't get their teenagers away from it. So I'm wondering how you think this stuff should be regulated.
Well, you know, I've talked about age gating quite a bit. Like, we age gate a lot of things. Having so many kids, I spent a lot of time thinking about it. But my kids weren't particularly. I think the people that are really got a problem with are 30 to 50. They're the crazy ones in the middle there, the addicted ones. Younger people, 25 and under, maybe 22 and under to, you know, 18 to 21, really have it together, I think, in a lot of ways. They have a real sense of how to use it because they've grown up with it. And it kind of reminded me when I was a kid where I watched a lot of television and they said, oh, you're going to become an idiot. It's the boob tube. That's what they called it.
That's right.
And they did. And, you know,
you sound like my dad.
Your brain. Yeah. Hey, don't watch the boob tube. And, you know, was that time wasted? I don't know. Video games didn't turn out to be as bad. You know, they're addictive. I think this stuff is very addictive in a different way from either of those two things. And I think it isolates and other things. So we need to understand what's happening by getting data from these companies, which they don't want to share unless a whistleblower gives it to us. But I think they remind me a little bit of cigarettes. So I think there should be warnings. I think there should be age gating. I think it has elements of if you took cigarettes and television and mashed them together and then you couldn't, then you had it strapped on your face. You know, the television, that would be what it is.
You could almost see the commercial, right? Giving a kid a cigarette, right? Or like you see it,
yeah.
Right? Like, you know, but would you, you know, then you give him a phone, right? We see it.
It's media on steroids. And so we have to think about it. And of course, we're addicted ourselves, parents. So it's not the whole, and more importantly, you need to have it to work. You can't not have it. So it's a cigarette you cannot not smoke, right? So,
and kids increasingly need it for school. Like, you can't even pull it away because of so much that's being done. Kara, let's get to the book, The Burn. And we were thinking, Tim and I were like, how do we want to start with her? How do we want to start with her? If you were interviewing yourself, sitting in your red steel case chairs, what would be your first question to yourself? And you sometimes come out tough first.
Yes, I do. Not always. Sometimes I'm a charmer.
That's true.
I think, why do you still love it? Why do you still? Well, no, if you want to be tough to me, are you obsessed with Elon Musk?
Are you?
No, he's obsessed. He's obsessed with me. He's the one that, and listen, did you see the blurbs on the blurb?
We did.
Yes, we did. Yeah.
Well,
we can't read them.
We can't, Kara, say them all, which is why everybody needs to read the book.
I know. What I did is I replaced blurbs with nasty things tech boys say about me, and I used it for marketing. Because if they want to strafe a woman, great, I'll use it for selling my book. That sounds good to me. They're trying to, as if I'm going to be some delicate flower and melt at their insults. Like, give me a break.
Well, you know, what's interesting about Elon in your book, and you like make these points of that there's parts of him that, how can you not be kind of a little bit enamored where he's, you know, trying to do work on really serious problems, right? It's not like, how do I download music again? Like, kind of thing. And you have your P2P ratio, which you can't say. People have to read the book to understand what it is, because this is a clean show. but so how do you cross like these people who think differently and yet there are some real big concerns?
Well, he's a case study in someone who's lost the narrative rather significantly.
Why did he lose it, do you think, in your view?
I don't know. I'm not his mama. I think I think COVID played a part in it. I think he's a perfect example of that age range, sort of, I guess it's 30 to 60, he's a little older than that, which makes you wonder how he loves the boob jokes at that age, at 52 or 53, whoever he is. I think he was doing things that were amazing. I have to say, the cars, and he didn't invent Tesla, but he certainly is a business genius there. And same thing with SpaceX, business genius. He's taken the talents of other people and himself and made it into really interesting businesses. Even the tunnel digging one is cool in a way. Hyperloop is a great idea. So he had big ideas, and I'll tell you, that's what attracted me to him. Because everyone else was doing, you know, a digital dry cleaning service, exhausting.
Should we continue to take him seriously?
I wish we could, but he's sort of he's indulged himself in his manias. And so every day he's tweeting hateful things, and not every day every minute he's doing that, he's not inventing the future. You know, he's inventing, he's reinventing hate is what he's doing. Grievance. He's reinventing grievance.
We are seeing Starship reach new highs.
Sure. Yeah. Well, sure. But he's getting to experiment on the U.S. dime. He's having U.S. contracts, which is, thank you, federal government. Yes, that's right. He is doing that. But there's other people there. I think we attribute because we have an idolatry of innovators. We think he's the only one, like he's Willy Wonka in there making all the candy. He's not, you know. And so I have a great regard for Gwynne Shotwell, a name you don't hear very often.
Right, the president.
Runs SpaceX.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She runs SpaceX, let's be clear. I mean, she will stand aside for him, but from what I understand, she's the driving force of that company. And Tesla the same way. There's a lot of executives there who, and by the way, they're under a great deal of stress now given all the competition and the fall off in computer, the fall off in consumer sentiment in general and in particular with him.
Hey, Kara, I do want to, one more on Elon and then we're going to move on.
Sure.
Hopefully. Mm-hmm.
He's the character of the moment.
So he really is. And you know, you've known him for years and you write about in the book that you knew him in the early years of the PayPal years.
When he had his, not PayPal, he wasn't PayPal. He didn't create PayPal. He created X.com.
Right,
just
right.
Just for people to know. So, everyone says he founded PayPal. He did not found PayPal.
He's obviously evolved since then.
He had a company called, he had a company called Zip2. That was a Yellow Pages online thing. Then he went to X.com, and then he started doing the more interesting things.
So he evolved, obviously, since then, and he's evolved to where he is now. Are you optimistic that this evolution could continue and you could see a different Elon Musk in a few years?
No, I don't. I don't. I think he's well past the sell-by date at this point. You know, he's devolved is what's happened. He was really interesting. What's interesting, I get a lot of a flack for liking him then. It was a lot to like. There's a lot to like, especially compared to other people. And I know he had his problems. I'm aware. We wrote about them extensively on our site, the issues around sexual harassment and racial issues at the factories. Again, it was a problem throughout Silicon Valley. We also wrote about Uber. But no, I think he's just in love with himself and his fans, and he's got people slavishly licking him up and down all day. And I think rich people, the deleterious effects of wealth on your psyche in this case, and also the radicalization of online right-wing conspiracy swamps has really gotten a hold of him. I don't know how he's going to get out.
Hey, Kara, before we go any further into the book, in the book, you talk a lot about, obviously, the tech industry, the folks you've, reported on, talked to, but you also talk about your dad and his passing, and you were very young, how that shaped you. You also talk about your conversations with Steve Jobs. A lot of this just kind of resonated with me and really struck me, the idea of facing mortality in general. How that, both of those, obviously not apples to apples, but how that shaped you as an individual and your professional life and maybe how you approach things and even report on things.
Very much. And I know this is a real selling point, but the book is about death and about life, creation and destruction, which is what the tech industry is about, right? That things go, come and go. And my own life, I have that resonant with my dad dying at a young age, my wonderful father dying at a young age, and the impact it had on me, which gave me an early sense of mortality that stuck with me, which meant I had no time to waste. I must get things done. I must change and grow and shift because I didn't have that kind of time. And I think Steve Jobs had a similar sentiment in general, and then in particular when he got sick. Most of the things he created that we think of him as famous for, although he had a long career, was in that last few years he lived. The iPhone, just a lot of stuff got created when his mortality was weighing on him. He gave a great speech at Stanford about that. So I think we did spark on that issue of time's a wasting. Let's get going.
You spent a lot of time in the book talking about Steve Jobs, and he's not one of the characters that you write about him in a way that
you
I think.
You seem to like him.
Yeah, you do. You really seem to like him.
I did like him.
Very clear.
And I'm wondering what he would think of.
He's a difficult guy. Difficult guy,
right.
By the way. Often, only on product that I ever saw him be difficult, but he had his warts. There's no question.
What would he think about where we are today politically?
He was much more liberal, but in the traditional sense, I think. He always was trying to reach out. He spent a lot of time talking to Rupert Murdoch, trying to get him to stop being so Rupert Murdoch-y. He always was trying to find, I wouldn't say he's a peaceful person, because that's clearly not the case. But I do think he was a seeker, he was widely read. One of the things I liked about him was that he read widely, and he had other experiences that had nothing to do with tech. And he had a sense of design and a very big respect for privacy, that's for sure. He also could see around corners. Like, he talked about podcasting with me very first of all. He talked about privacy with me very early. Talked about the problems of social media being a really toxic business model. early on. And it wasn't just in his self-interest. I think he thought that. I think he would have hated much of some of what's going on. Some of it he would have liked.
Stories that didn't make the book, were there a lot?
Mm-hmm. Lots. It's largely, if everyone's asked me that, I have a lot. And as I'm on this book tour, I'm like, oh, remember that? Or someone will write me, do you remember when I was like, yeah, I don't know. I feel like if I've forgotten them, they weren't important, right? Yeah. Or, I don't have a lot about Yahoo. I wrote a lot about Yahoo's ups and downs over the years, and I just didn't think it mattered at this point. Like, I put in the amount that I thought mattered. Certain companies, there was a company someone mentioned the other day, and I wrote a lot about it, and I was like, oh, yeah, like that. Like, I run thousands and thousands of stories and interviewing thousands of people, and so... I don't know. It's gone. Sorry.
That's okay. But like, we talked about Elon, Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg's in the book, Sheryl Sandberg, Dave Goldberg, Bill Gates, Reid Hoffman, mm-hmm. everybody who's anyone in the tech industry over mm-hmm. the last couple of decades and then some. If you had one person that you could just sit down and just go everywhere and anywhere, alive or not, who would it be?
It'd still be Steve. He was the most interesting interview I did. There's a lot of interesting ones I really enjoy. It depends. Satya Nadella I find really interesting because he's had a very interesting life being an immigrant. He has family challenges. Mm-hmm. His kids have learning issues and quite severely. He's a real person. I think, I'm trying to think, I always like talking to Barry Diller. He's just fantastic. And he's someone who changes
right?
and shifts.
Yeah.
Not just that, he's so smart. A lot of stuff he said when I go back and look at it is spot on. I just did an interview with him about copyright and AI, and he was the first to that, understanding that. I just think he's funny. I just think he's smart. I think he thinks about a lot of things. I always enjoy talking to him. I'm trying to think of who in tech. I like talking to Sam Altman. He's got a very quick mind, and he always did. And it's really developed. I like anyone who developed. I have to say, someone living, Mark Cuban. He's a gas. He's interesting.
I love him on Shark Tank. I'm a little obsessed with that show.
Beyond that, he's a really thoughtful person and smart. He did a whole thing on DEI on mm-hmm. Twitter, and I literally was like, Godspeed, Mark. Like, these people are just going to call you names, including Elon Musk. He's like, you're a moron. He's very thoughtful and has progressed.
Kara, I do want to, we only have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to get a few more questions in. You didn't talk at all about this in the book, but politics in San Francisco. I know in the past you mm-hmm. toyed with the idea of running for mayor of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. You were very serious about it at a certain point. Given what's going on in San Francisco now and your prominence, your love for the city, would you ever consider that again?
No, I had two kids during COVID instead, two more kids. So no, I don't have the time to do that. I have two toddlers. Going on in San Francisco, actually San Francisco is solving the problem. Other cities are now suffering from what San Francisco initially is. San Francisco is always first, good or bad, right? Mm. And so they're doing some innovative things. They're trying to change things. Most cities are suffering because of COVID and the fall off in commercial real estate and the changes in work. And San Francisco got a hit first. And I think look, guess what's happening in San Francisco right now? All the AI companies are there now. Yeah. All the important AI.
Everyone's moving back.
Done there. Oh, yeah, they are. Oh, the guys who just kicked it in the teeth and then ran off, they're back because it's the best place on earth for innovation still. And so it's the most beautiful place, and we have our problems. We're not running away from it. But we also have it is a magical place, and it always has been, through the summer of love to the gold rush to everything else. It's a physically beautiful place. It always has ideas. And I do believe in analog in some places. And I have to say, in history, it will go down as one of the great important cities of humanity.
All right. We just have 30 seconds
and
left.
And I'm running for mayor now. No, I'm not.
We just want a headline. You know that. Hey, 30 seconds.
No, I'm sorry.
No, 30 seconds. How would you advise a Kara Swisher just beginning her career today? Because media has changed dramatically, very quickly. And forgive me for not giving you more time.
That's okay. Be exactly who you were and are. That's what I'd say. You're pretty good.
Amen, sister. Amen. Listen, good luck. We really enjoyed the read. And thank you so much for giving us such a big chunk of time. So appreciate it. Kara Swisher, everybody. Thank you. Her new book is Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. Got to say, there's so many great tidbits about being in the green room with individuals, being on stage with Mark Zuckerberg and others, and just getting into a lot of the topics that we, you and I, talk about a lot day to day.
Also just interesting on the business side, hearing how the audiobook is outselling the print book.
I love listening
to the podcast effect.
Walk the dogs, did a lot of things.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
This is what gets us to this next story that we want to do with Rachel Metz. It's about OpenAI, which has been at the center of all things artificial intelligence ever since Microsoft did that $10 billion investment in the company. That was January of last year, right? And it's what got us all talking about AI, which has been around for a long time, but obviously this is kind of a whole other level. But anyway, that's what got us talking about it. Rachel, of course, is Bloomberg News AI reporter. She's with us from San Francisco. I think she went to the teacher and said, can we have class outside today? Because that's what it looks like. Rachel, good to have you here with us. Your story about OpenAI now sprinting to keep up with the startups. Remind us about this company, why they've been so much a part of the AI conversation and why they're now kind of trying to keep up.
Sure. So OpenAI, I mean, they've been doing interesting stuff for quite a while, but ChatGPT, I think, is what got a lot of people really talking about them in late 2022. And in the time since, a lot of people, other companies have been working on generating video. So it's like you type in some words, like a teddy bear walking down the street, for instance, and the AI model produces a very short video of that sort of thing, hopefully. And a few companies are working on this kind of stuff, and OpenAI is now saying, hey, wait, we're working on this too, and we can do it as good or better than you can.
Can they?
That is an excellent question. They have this model, Sora, which
the videos are pretty cool.
Good.
Freaked me
they
out.
They do look really cool.
I didn't know there were woolly mammoths where you were able to film woolly mammoths.
They're real, back. Aren't they?
I mean, they existed a
yeah,
while ago.
Yeah, they're real. They did exist a while ago. No, I mean, it's hard to say actually how good it is because it's still a research project. They have not said when they will release it as a consumer product.
I will say it is so good it's scary, Rachel. That was my impression of it.
Well, but you have to keep in mind that they're just showing you what they want you to see, right? Like we haven't gotten access to it directly. And I mean, a handful of people outside the company have access right now. They're creators, but it hasn't been revealed yet what all those people are working on. So it's hard to say how good it really is, right? If you can't actually try it yourself. At least that's how I feel about these things. If I can't try it, how good is it really?
Okay, so I think that's a really fair, that's why you're the AI reporter. I think that's a really fair way to put it. Okay, so let's talk about some of the other AI startups. I mean, OpenAI gets a lot of the attention because of all the money that it's received and the drama that we had in the fall with the board and Sam Altman and the Microsoft partnership, of course. But tell us about some of the other companies that are working on AI-generated video right now.
Sure. Well, one of the biggest names is a company called Runway. And to be fair, they've been working on this stuff for several years now. And they put out the first model that sort of like anybody could access. That was last year. It was just about a year ago, actually, that I wrote a story about like, hey, you can now use this. So Runway has this AI model called Gen 2, and it's text to video. So you type in a prompt and it gives you a short video. They've made a lot of progress over the past year, allowing people to make videos that are higher resolution, that are longer. And there's other companies, one called Pika. Pika is a company that just released their first model late this year. Stability AI has a model of their own called Stable Video, and a company called Piper has their own model as well. So I tried out all of these in the course of reporting this story, just to get a sense of where they're at.
But the race is on, and it's, you know, interesting. We were just, you know, talking with Kara Swisher and just this idea of, you know, companies kind of disrupting one another, right? And you think there's a leader and then somebody else comes out and all of a sudden, and you know, what an interesting week where we have, you know, Apple, you know, doubling down on its partnership with Google when it comes to AI. Like, it's just, there's a lot of movement going around, you know, or going on, or people acquiring companies and so on and so forth. So, you know, as you look at this space, it just feels like there's a lot of new companies, and it's curious kind of where they all ultimately will land and who will ultimately survive, or will they all? I don't know.
Yeah, at this point, it seems to me like it's still quite early stage. Like, it can be a challenge just to get a video produced, with a text prompt that actually is showing you kind of what you wanted. So it's still like very early there. But at the same time, I think with Sora, what I've been hearing from companies is that even just opening AI, showing off Sora, not even releasing it yet, is making the existing companies excited. It helped one of them, they said, with recruiting. It's just making people interested in seeing what is possible with these tools. Even if that's a little ways out, I think they're still pretty positive that competition is actually really helpful at this point.
Rachel, we know what it takes for self-driving. We know what it takes for the large language models. What does it take compute-wise to make one of these videos?
That is a really good question. It takes a lot. It's off the top of my head, I don't know like exactly how it
but it's intensive
to generating. Yeah, to generating like a single image. But you can imagine like a single image is a teeny fraction of what is in a video, right? And if you multiply that out over time, you're getting an orders of magnitude higher for like 10 seconds of video versus like 100 frames of just images. So yeah, it's a lot. More compute, more money, more memory.
We've actually got the, I think, OpenAI Sora video up.
That's a cute dog.
It's a cute dog. It's all not real, folks. It was generated. I have to say, Rachel, we're showing it
up. Are those cute fish?
Our YouTube and our streaming folks.
Some guy running backwards on a treadmill.
When my husband first showed it to me, yeah, he was like, hey, honey, none of this is real. Like, it's crazy town, right?
Yeah. No, that's a really good thing to be hyper aware of as well. It does increase issues related to misinformation too.
You're real and your background's real, right? Just tell me that.
Yeah, it's fuzzy, but it is real.
Okay. So glad that we could check in with you as always. Bloomberg's Rachel Metz, she's our AI reporter, joining us from the lovely outside area of San Francisco. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Let's get to it. We've got a great guest to talk about the market moves and particularly what we got from the Federal Reserve today. And Jay Powell, the chair of course, the Federal Reserve. Katie Kaminsky is with us in our drive to the close here, just about 10 minutes left in the trading session. Chief Research Strategist and Portfolio Manager at Alpha Simplex, joining us once again, joining us from Boston. Katie, great to have you here with us. So excited. Tell us about the Fed and what we got from Jay Powell and from the FOMC. How do you interpret at some point just kind of the nuances, upping growth estimates, also upping inflation estimates? So how do you make sense of it?
Well, I think the commentary was definitely leaving a lot of room for wiggle room. And I think if you look at the voting as well, if there are 10 votes on three and 9 votes for two or less, that isn't a slam dunk for three. So I'd say that, you know, they're kind of treading lightly to make sure that they can adjust should we start to see some inflation numbers and also the data start to come in a little bit on the upside for inflation, if they need to pause a little bit more. And that's, you've been seeing that in the markets. I mean, especially commodity markets this month have made me pay attention. Mm. They were talking about gold earlier. So some of the commodity markets have been moving quite a bit, so.
Katie, you know I'm going there because back in August, you were on the program, you told us a 10-year at 6% is what we could see. Is that still something in this cycle you think we could see?
I think, you know, everything is feasible, but the truth is, I think we're pretty far from that at this point. I mean, I think you'd have to go to a very extreme stagflationary environment. And right now, growth is still very strong. So I think that's an area where you have a much steeper yield curve and you sort of have much higher yields would require something like stagflation. And we're just not anywhere close to that. But everything's possible. Everything's in certain environments.
What's more likely? You know, I'm looking at a 10-year at 4.27 right now. Is it more likely that we see maybe 5%? Or is that something that you kind of rule out at this point?
Well, I think, it's going to depend on what happens. I mean, my biggest question has been, what does it mean for cutting rates if inflation is still higher?
Good point.
That's sort of a strange scenario. So if we get into that scenario and inflation is ticking up and, you know, you've been cutting rates on the short end, at some point you might need a little bit of a, you know, some sort of premium on longer term debt. And so I think that's where people will expect higher yields on the longer end, if that's the case. But right now, it looks like things are very much range bound. At least that's what we've seen in the fixed income markets.
I mean, is it a little odd or is it Goldilocks? You know, in that the FOMC median 2024 core PCE inflation estimate moved up to 2.6% versus 2.4%. So a little bit higher, right? Higher for longer. Like, we get the message. And certainly the FOMC feels that way. Bumping up the 2024 GDP forecast to 2.1% from 1.4%. Estimate for long run growth path remained at 1.8%. But it just feels like, okay, these are numbers that show the economy is doing okay. But maybe that's what speaks to then the possibility of some of those FOMC members saying maybe it's only 2 rate cuts this year. But can we also say maybe no rate cuts this year? Could the Fed get to that point at some point down the road if things stay strong?
Well, I'd say the equity market agrees with you today.
Yeah, right.
But in addition to that, I mean, I think we've been, as looking for higher rates more often in the past than some. And what I would say is that's still very much a possibility. And why I'm interested in the commodity markets is if we continue to see increases in prices and we start to see other areas where inflation just isn't going away, then they're leaving room to make at some point in time much later time. And that's been happening all this year. We keep delaying. It looked a little more likely now, but really there's still always room. They're leaving room to do that.
To do what? Wait.
To wait.
Okay.
To wait to cut. It's definitely leaving room, although, you know, they're indicating they'd like to, but, you know, I want to see it before I believe it. So, I guess Bank of Japan might be a good example of that. It, you know, can take longer than you think.
Katie, we know that the Fed is independent and it's been asked about its independence in the past, independent from political concerns, but we are in an election year. And we had some folks on our air yesterday talking about political concerns as we do get closer to the election and cutting closer to the election. So we have May, June, July, September, and November left in meetings before the election. What happens to the Federal Reserve in those next few meetings? Like, is there a chance that there's going to have to be a rate cut at three meetings in a row, or we get too close to an election and they don't want to cut rates too close to an election?
Well, I would guess they probably would be reticent to cut to signal anything that's not independent to the market. But, you know, it does put some pressure on. There's only so many meetings left. And that's why I said, you know, nine of the votes were two or less, and people focused on the three cuts instead of the two or less. And I think you might end up with two or maybe one or two, and you know that would still probably be a step in that direction. But I think around an election, there's just so much uncertainty, and there's also, you know, concern about independence.
And then just a quick correction: the Fed meeting in November is on November 7th, which is actually the day after the general election in the United States, which is set for Tuesday, November 5th.
Party on, right? They can do whatever they want.
That's going to be busy. Yeah. No, I mean, I guess they could theoretically, but it would be definitely a very interesting time with, you know, the election ongoing.
Katie, is it safe to say that, you know, Jay Powell is not going to come out and say it's appropriate to begin easing at some point this year? I'm going to obsess over this. We're all going to obsess with it. That he wouldn't put that out there if he didn't really believe that it's going to happen? Or can he come back at some point? I mean, he is the Fed chair, he is data dependent, but would he lay that out if he really thought, you know what, we just might not do anything this year?
Well, I think they want to cut. It's just they're trying to get enough evidence in the data to do so. So I think there's definitely a desire to cut rates for concern of potential impact on financial conditions. But if they're not seeing enough evidence, like I, you know, like I was saying before, what kind of central bank is going to cut rates when inflation is high?
Right.
It seems like not a really, it could be a policy mistake. So I think they're going to have to tread lightly and continue to look at the data, but they're leaving it open so that they can adjust as they get more information.
Hey, really quickly, 25 seconds. What's your best bet right now when you want to play the Treasury curve?
Oh, I think right now, it's been a little bit against me, but we've been short fixed income and especially the 2 year, it's not working today, but definitely seeing short signals have been working well. This higher for longer theme has been working well. But outside of treasuries, I think the better place to look is in commodities as well. So gold,
commodities,
copper. Yeah.
Okay.
Love I've been it. Moving a lot.
All right. Yeah. Listen, Katie, so glad to have you on this Fed Wednesday. Katie Kaminsky, be well. Katie is Chief Research Strategist, Portfolio Manager at Alpha Simplex, joining us from Boston.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.